you can call it narcissistic or self-centered, but after I record these podcasts, I do actually listen to them, and I criticize myself, and I yell at myself, and I say, oh, you should have said this, or you should have said that. But what I've noticed as I listen to these podcasts is that I guess I'm kind of hard on the books that I read. And sometimes I sit there and wonder why I'm so critical about the books I read, where it comes off that sometimes I'm actually angry. I don't know whether it's angry at the author or angry at myself that I actually read the book that ended up not being as satisfying as I hoped. But I find that I am angry, and it comes out in the podcasts, and I don't want to give off the wrong impression because I'm not angry. I love reading, obviously, or else I wouldn't be doing this. But I think that the anger, if that's what you want to call it, or the dissatisfaction, is frustration, I guess, with the books I read, is really from a place of jealousy. And the jealousy is that I don't really have the discipline or the time to write a book of my own, even though I would love to have the feeling of accomplishment of actually completing a book. But I'm jealous of the people who can do it, jealous of the people who can sit down, take a blank page, and write a 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 page book. And I feel that when these authors have such a gift of that ability, that I guess maybe I feel like I need to hold them to a higher standard, that they need to be really good at it, that somehow or other somebody read what they wrote and thought that it was worth publishing. And if I feel that the book just doesn't succeed, then maybe I'm angry at the fact that these people got publishers, and I don't know that I have a lot of confidence in myself that should I write something on my own that it would ever see the light of day. But I don't want any of you listeners to think that I'm an angry person, or to think that I harbor some ill will towards the authors, because I really don't. I do get frustrated that I sometimes deviate from the standard fare, whether they be specific genres or authors, and try out new things and find out that the new things just weren't as satisfying as the old reliables that I certainly have on my shelf. But I don't know, I just didn't want you to get the feeling that I'm an angry person, or that I'm always yelling or always scowling, because I don't feel that way. I do utilize this podcast as a way to kind of release frustration. And believe me, I'm reading these books sometimes and I'm really frustrated. I'm frustrated about things that I see as inconsistencies, or I'm frustrated about the fact that the book jacket sometimes doesn't exactly reflect what the book is truly about, and I feel like I've been duped or misled into buying a book and reading a book that has no resemblance to what the book jacket says. And in fact, one of the books we're going to talk about this week, it kind of fit that bill. But what's interesting is I've got four books to discuss with you. I'll go through them pretty quickly, but they're all sort of related to each other. Three of them take place same time frame, same location. And the fourth book, which I just finished today, is actually tangentially related to two of those other three books. So the first book that I wanted to talk about is called Mayhem by Sarah Pimborough. And I alluded to this at the end of the last podcast, that it was a sort of a Jack the Ripper type novel, and I felt pretty good about the book. I found it on, I think it was Amazon, and ordered it on my Kindle, and didn't know that the book was actually being released that week. And so as I picked it up, as it got downloaded onto my Kindle, I ended up going to Barnes & Noble, looking around and finding that the book was available there as well. And it was an interesting twist on the Jack the Ripper story, because it wasn't a Jack the Ripper story. It takes place the exact same time frame as the Jack the Ripper murders. It takes place in the exact same place in London, except it has to do with a different set of murders that I guess historically is accurate, were also taking place at the same time as the Jack the Ripper murders. And these were called the Thames Torso murders. And the reason why they were called that is because the murderer would chop up his victim into pieces and deposit those pieces into the Thames River. And as the pieces of the body were fished out of the river, the Scotland Yard, the detectives, and the medical examiners were having a hard time basically putting the body parts together to determine who the victims were, because in a lot of instances, they never located the head. And so this book tracks the character Dr. Bond, who is the medical examiner for Scotland Yard during the time of the Jack the Ripper murders. And this is his investigation into the Thames Torso murders. And there is a little allusion to Jack the Ripper. There are some passages in the book that talk about the Jack the Ripper murders and the fact that some of the detectives believe that these Thames Torso murders were also the work of Jack the Ripper. But this Dr. Bond is very, very clear in his belief that they are not the work of Jack the Ripper. And so he goes off onto another path of discovery to solve the crimes. And when you think about a book like that and in the story or the synopsis that I just gave you, you get a little bit excited. I got a little excited. This was going to be a kind of a worthwhile read. It was going to be dark. It was going to be gritty. It was going to be a little gory. But there was going to be some really good payoff at the end. And what you find out through the book is that Dr. Bond is actually teamed up with two other characters. One of them seems to be some sort of a priest, and the other one is a foreigner from Russia, I think. And somehow or other, the three of them are all aligned in finding out the killer of these brutally ravaged women. And they weren't prostitutes like Jack the Ripper's victims were prostitutes. So that was another indication that Dr. Bond believes this was not these were not Jack the Ripper murders. But it had such promise as it started out. And what I like about the Jack the Ripper novels, the ones that I've read, is that it seems as if the characters themselves have some foundation in potential reality. So even though the books are fictional, the authors still create real people. And there's no sense of mysticism about the murders. There's no sense of fantasy about it. That it's just as much of a plausible explanation for the murders as any other plausible explanation that the experts have concocted over the past 125 years. But this book really took a decidedly strange right turn when it basically intimated that the murders committed were the result of some sort of a fantasy creature. And that just did not jibe well with me. Because it basically, if I can analogize this story, you talk about how movies get made, and you look at all the movies that were made after Die Hard, and you think of Speed, Die Hard on a bus, and you think of Under Siege, Die Hard on a boat, and you think of Under Siege 2, Die Hard on a train, and you know all this kind of stuff. And if I were to encapsulate this book, I would tell you that it's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde meets Fantasyland, meets something that is the work of fairies, because what you end up finding out is that the evil doer, the murderer, was on vacation in Eastern Europe someplace and drank out of some river, and by drinking out of the river, it created in him this extraterrestrial being that controlled him to create these murders. And you get the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde aspect of it, because while this being is controlling him, he is not aware of what's going on. And he finishes, the being controls him to finish the deed, and then he kind of zaps out of it and looks around and doesn't really realize what happened. So it kind of was like a little bit of a cop-out to me, that there was no plausible method or plausible explanation for these murders, and that the author had to create this supernatural being. And that really was disappointing. And I really kind of felt that the book fell apart once it got into that type of a storyline. Because up until then, I was really enjoying it. There was a couple of different story arcs when you talk about the priest and you talk about the foreigner and Dr. Bond, the medical examiner. You saw a little bit of the murderer, the foreword or the chapter one, the preface, whatever it was actually the murder being committed. And, it creates this darkening mood and this this expectation that you're going to continue to see these types of darkening murders and horrific, you know, dismemberments. But it didn't really go much further than that. We found out that at one point Dr. Bond goes to the opium dens, which figures into one of the other books as well, that I'm going to talk about later. But he goes to the opium dens and he sees the priest there, and the priest is taking some special kind of medicine or special kind of intoxicant, a drug, and it lets him see, you know, see into the other people, lets them see their souls, or lets them see, you know, whatever auras they have, and that this is how he's going to track down the murderer, because when he takes this medication, this intoxication, this drug, whatever it is, then the supernatural being is going to be exposed to him. And it really was just kind of like, what? This is the best you could come up with? This is the explanation you have, that this guy drank from a well and the supernatural being attached itself to him? And then this priest, who for reasons unknown, I don't think we ever find out why he's there, or what he's doing there, or how he found how he knew to come to London, or whatever it is. But now he's just supposed to take this drug, and he'll be able to see where the bad guy is. And it really just kind of felt all thrown together. Like, how can I make, if the author said, how can I make a Jack the Ripper type novel, but also incorporate Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but I don't want to really use any plausible explanations for this, so I'm going to create something that is from Fantasyland. And it just didn't really work well with me. At the end of the day, the bad guy, of course, gets it, but the doctor does something which is a little bit unsettling, and there's no real kind of resolution. You don't walk out of the book, or you don't finish the book and say that I felt like, you know, justice was served, and that all is well with the world again. So I wouldn't really recommend it that highly. If it's something you're interested in, I'd say go ahead and read it. But it really didn't do a whole lot for me. I was really, really expecting more. The first half of it I thought was really inventive and intoxicating, or not intoxicating, but endearing. And it just kind of fell apart from there. Now, the second book I read also takes place at just about the same time. It's called The Mangle Street Murders by M.R.C. Kasasian, K-A-S-A-S-I-N. And this is an offspring of the Sherlock Holmes type of storyline, because it involves a woman this time who is sent to live with a gentleman who has a lot of similarities to Sherlock Holmes. And he is a private investigator, right? And he goes through on many times saying he's not a private investigator, he's a public investigator or something along those lines. Of course, she is far smarter and more, more adept at solving crimes than he is, but he's the one who's got the pedigree and the notoriety, and she is just a country woman who is now coming to live in the big city of London. And of course, it's taking place all at the same time, the 1880s, 1890s in London. And the Sherlock Holmes character is named Sidney Grice. And in the introduction, you find out that Sidney Grice has long been hailed as this, bastion of justice, and his stories were written down in stories and Hollywoodized, so you get the feeling that this is really Sherlock Holmes. And then the woman who comes to live with him, she's like a teenager at the time, and her name is March. And she's, of course, very, very smart, and she's bucking the trends of how women are supposed to act. They're not supposed to go into the police station and interrogate witnesses. They're not supposed to go into the morgue and look at dead bodies. They're not supposed to really allow themselves to be put into situations in which, you know, they're going to be disgusted or outrageous types of situations. But she's bucking the trend. She's the one who's, you know, kind of pushing the women's liberation movement all alone. And she and Sidney Grice end up trying to solve a murder. And the murderer is a gentleman who has already been arrested, and he has been arrested for the murder of his wife, and they own a shop together. And his claim is that while he was asleep, taking a nap in a chair in one room, she was being hacked to death in the next room, and that he had nothing to do with it. But while he's in jail, he sends a note to Sidney Grice via his mother-in-law. His mother-in-law comes and delivers it and says, please, Sidney, you have to help him. You have to help get him exonerated for the crime. And Sidney, just after the first meeting with the defendant, believes that he did it, and everything that he does, every step of the way, he is attempting to locate evidence to support the fact that he believes that this guy is actually the killer. Meanwhile, March has looked into the killer's eyes, or the quote-unquote killer's eyes, and believes him to truly be innocent of the crime. And so every step of the way, while they're going to the crime scene and they're interviewing witnesses, Sidney is looking for information and evidence that will support his theory that the guy did it, and March is looking for evidence and information to support her theory that he didn't do it. And of course, there's a lot of banter and interplay between the two of them, and it's a pretty straightforward Sherlock Holmes type of a story. It did do some things pretty well, which I thought were commendable. It did a very good job of kind of illustrating the differences in the classes between the upper class and the lower class in London at that time. They do one of the locations that they go to examine evidence is kind of a real slummy area of London, and they do the author does a really good job of explaining. Describing the scene and describing how the people lived and describing the woman who is, has a baby sleeping, and yet, baby sleeping on her chest, all the while she's offering to basically whore herself out for money to Sidney. And I read a book a long time ago by Leslie King. No, not Leslie. Laurie King. And Laurie King is a well-known author for writing Sherlock Holmes novels. But her take on the story is Sherlock Holmes is now long since retired, and he has a housemaiden, a woman, and she basically takes on his duties as being the detective. And so it's, again, the interplay between he and the woman and the bucking of societal norms and expectations. But the first book I read, called The Beekeeper's Apprentice, I didn't really enjoy it that much. I thought that the writing was a little too stuffy. I thought that the Sherlock Holmes character was not particularly enjoyable to read, and I didn't really like the female character that much. This one was not anywhere near as literary as The Beekeeper's Apprentice. But I liked it better, I think, because the story flowed quickly. The chapters were short, and the book moved. I mean, the book really moved along, and I did enjoy it slightly a little bit more than I enjoyed Mayhem. But one of the things that I did not like about the book is the bad guy doesn't get it at the end. We find out who the bad guy is, and it was a little obvious. I think it's a 300-page book or so, and about page 200, I had it figured out who did it. I didn't understand why, and I didn't get the full... I hadn't been able to piece together how it was done, but I understood who the bad guy was. But the bad guy basically gets away with it because Sidney and March figured out what the bad guy is going to do, what the bad guy's plans are, and they try and get ahead of the bad guy, but the bad guy gets away. And the bad guy gets away by getting onto a cruise ship sailing for some faraway distant place. I don't remember where it was. And so they get to the docks, and by the time they get to the docks, they find out that the ship has already sailed, and in fact, the ship that they want, the bad guy changed reservations and got on a different ship. And so you kind of don't get the closure because the bad guy, quote-unquote, gets away. Now, you do learn in, like, the last chapter, second to last chapter, that the ship that the bad guy was allegedly on had some sort of a tough time and ended up sinking, and all the people on board were lost or whatever it is. So you're supposed to assume that means that the bad guy ended up being killed, but you never really find that out. You're never really sure. And so that kind of bothered me. It's like, why not just wrap it up? Why not let Sidney and March save the day? Why not let them, get the bad guy and bring the bad guy to justice and all that kind of stuff. So it was a little bit of a, a cop-out from that standpoint, that they couldn't wrap it up in a way that would have the bad guy getting what the bad guy deserved. But I did like the book enough that I would be interested in reading more, and I anticipate that there will be more by this author, more books of Sidney Grice and March Middleton. One of the funny things was that towards the end of the book, March Middleton goes to visit the doctor for whatever it was, I don't remember, and the doctor asks about her employer, about Sidney Grice, and it turns out that the doctor is Arthur Conan Doyle, and something is said that kind of gives Arthur Conan Doyle the idea that maybe he should create his own literary figure, which ends up being Sherlock Holmes, and you get the feeling that it's based on the Sidney Grice character. That's what the author wants to at least intimate to the reader. But so that was the Mangle Street Murders by Kasassian. And kind of by mistake or by coincidence, however you want to call it, the next book I read was also a Sherlock Holmes takeoff, although this one was a little bit more different than even the Mangle Street Murders. And this one's called The Arnafore Affair by Gregory Harrison. It's the first book by Gregory Harrison. I believe that it's going to be the first amongst many. And instead of Sherlock Holmes or Sidney Grice, the Sherlock Holmes character's name is Colin Pendragon, and his assistant, not being Dr. Watson, it's Ethan Pruitt. And Ethan Pruitt, similar to the Dr. Watson character in the Sherlock Holmes stories, Ethan Pruitt is the narrator of the story told from first person. And this story was much more in line with the Sherlock Holmes novels because it's not particularly suspenseful. It's not particularly dark. The Mangle Street Murders actually had some pretty dark portions to it, which I thought were creative. And the Arnafore Affair really doesn't. It's much more of a straightforward story. There's a murder on a country estate, and the lady of the manor calls for Colin Pendragon to come and help solve the mystery of who killed her husband on this country estate. And you find out that the family, the Arnafore family, has all types of dysfunction. The son, who is a drunk, and the daughter, who's a extreme feminist, and the niece is kind of in a coma because she was beaten into the coma at the same time that the man of the manor was being killed. And so there's this whole kind of straightforward Sherlock Holmesian investigation into the Arnafore murder. And at the same time, there's a side issue or a side story about a boy, probably just an early teenager, who comes to Pendragon and Pruitt asking for their help in locating his little sister, who is, I think, 11 or 12 years old, because she's run away from home and it's been many, many days and he can't find her. So that's a little bit of a sub-story, which I kept expecting that the two stories would come back together, but then I also was skeptical as to how they possibly could come back together. And at the end of the day, they don't really have anything to do with each other, but they are two kind of parallel stories that Pendragon and Pruitt are trying to solve at the same time. And what's interesting to me is, especially with that, so we'll talk about just the missing persons investigation to start out, is that they didn't seem to operate with any sense of urgency. The boy comes to talk to them and says, "My sister's missing." I think he actually speaks with Ethan Pruitt first, the assistant, because Pendragon was sleeping or taking a bath or whatever it was. And so Pruitt takes the information, says that he'll consult with Colin, and they'll come to the boy's house the next day to discuss with him about taking the case. Now, the kid has been gone for 2, 3, 4 days now, whatever it is. And they're going to take 24 hours to decide if they're going to even take this case. And then they're going to take the case, but then they have to have tea, and then they have to wait till the morning, and then they're going to do this. And it ends up, it feels like it's a week or more before they actually get the case settled, or at least they determine what happened to the girl. And I'm sitting there thinking, aren't you a little bit kind of eager to get this done because the kid's out there and the kid is alone and the kid's a minor and who knows what's happening to the kid. And you know that the kid and the two of them live in an area where it's primarily prostitutes and it's slummish. And, you know, you don't know that this kid wasn't abducted by some pervert or is sold off to slavery or whatever. You don't know what it is. And yet they kind of take their dandy ass time solving the mystery of the missing kid. And that just kind of really, every time they'd say, we know this is a big emergency, you know, we'll talk to you tomorrow. It's like, what do you mean talk to you tomorrow? Take care of something now. Go do something now. So that was just one aspect of the story that was a little bit nerve-wracking to me because I wanted the story to move along. And the story does take its time going from start to finish. It does plot along. The chapters were some of them long, some of them short, and the longer ones did kind of feel as if they were dragging on a little bit. At the end of the day, the murderer is, of course, revealed, and Pendragon does a nice job of bringing it all together by having basically all of the potential murderers in the same room, and then he goes through his analysis, and similar to, you know, like a Hercule Poirot or Sherlock Holmes, obviously, he explains the whole thing and lays out for everybody how the murder took place and who the culprit is. But there were a couple of things about it that were a little bit strange or different. I'm just going to say different, not strange. It's not any surprise here that Colin Pendragon and Ethan Prewitt are gay. And I'm going to take a drink, so I'm not going to be silent just to let that settle in. I'm just taking a drink. And it took me a little bit to kind of figure out if that was in fact the accurate that they were gay, because at one point Pendragon is taking a bath and Ethan is sitting in the bathroom and they're talking, and I think something is said or whatever it is, Ethan ends up getting into the bathtub with him. And there's a couple other allusions later on in the book to the relationship that the two of them have. And I just found that interesting. I know that there have been a lot of speculation about Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, that maybe they had some sort of a homosexual relationship, or at least homosexual underpinnings to their relationship. But this doesn't seem to be as around the way about it. It seems to come right out. And in fact, Ethan at one point says something about their relationship, that it's different or that people wouldn't understand it or something like that. But I like the book. I wish that it would have been a little bit more suspenseful. I wish it could have been a little bit more darker. What I found in this book and in Mayhem and in quite a few of the other books I've read is there's a lot of attention given to the opium dens. I remember that in some of the James McCreet novels I read. It was in Mayhem. It's in the Arnafor Affair, that the characters go to these opium dens. And after a while, I just kind of get bored with the opium den scenes. And they go to the opium den twice, I think. And after a while, I just kind of get bored with it. And I say, oh, they're going to the opium den again. And they all say a bit of the same thing, because I'm sure there's research on the opium dens of London in the 1880s and 1890s. And so all of the authors, I guess, are looking at the same information. And so they're consistent from that standpoint. But I just get tired of it. I get tired of the, just the concept of the opium dens. Although I'm certainly intrigued by it, that I would love to have seen what they were like. I can picture them in my head, and I'm really kind of interested in how they were in actuality. But I would prefer the cobblestone streets and the dark alleyways to the opium dens. Now, one of the things that this book and the Mangle Street Murders book I didn't like, is that the reader is dropped into the middle of the story. Not the middle of the mystery, the middle of the story. So with the Arnafor Affair, Pendragon and Prewitt already have a history together of solving crimes. And you learn a little bit that Ethan Prewitt has a little of his own history as a child, what his upbringing was, and they allude to it a little bit throughout the book. And that's an interesting aspect of the character that I would like to read more about. But both this book and the Sydney and the Mangle Street Murders, we're in the middle. the characters are established. Sidney Grice, Colin Pendragon, they're established. They're successful detectives. People seek them out. And you kind of feel like you're dropped a little bit in the middle of the story. Now, the Mangle Street Murders more closely aligned itself with the Sherlock Holmes stories, because if you'll recall, Sherlock Holmes, the first novel, I think it was The Sign of the Four, it basically begins with Dr. Watson being introduced to Sherlock Holmes, because I think Dr. Watson was back from the wars and needed a place to live, and so it was recommended that he live with Sherlock Holmes. And the Mangle Street Murders kind of dovetails nicely into that, because March Middleton needs a place to live, and she goes to live with Sidney Grice. And there's a reason why it's in the story of why she went there. But for the Arnafour affair, you're dropped right in the middle. Ethan and Colin already have an existing relationship. They have a history that you don't know anything about. You're just supposed to take it on face value that they're successful, that they're well known, and that they already have this well-established relationship. And I'm curious as to why the author chose to do that. I'm curious as to why the author chose to have us dropped into the middle of their relationship and not give us some sort of a genesis story. And when I think about it, I guess I can't really, off the top of my head, come up with very many books where you do start at the beginning. Whoever the main character of the book is, there's always a story behind that character. Even going back to my favorite character, Harry Bosch, we're dropped into the middle because he's already a police officer and he's already a homicide investigator. And we know through the course of the reading about his history, and we know about his experience in the Vietnam War as a tunnel rat and that kind of a thing. But I guess the question I would have for myself is, if I were to write a book, would I start at the beginning, or would I drop the reader right into the middle and craft a backstory? And I don't know. That's an interesting issue. I like the way Sherlock Holmes did it. I like the way Sidney Grice and March Middleton did it, where you're not exactly dropped into the middle, because the Sherlock Holmes, Sidney Grice characters do have a history, but you're dropped into, you're at the beginning of the relationship of the two characters together. You're at the beginning of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. You're at the beginning of Sidney Grice and March Middleton. In the Arnafour affair, you're not in the middle. You're not at the beginning of that relationship. You're in the middle. And I guess, I hope that maybe as the series continues, that the author does go to a genesis story and now say, and come to a book where he says, now you've heard them go on a series of adventures. Now let's see how they got started. So that's the Arnafour affair. There is a second book that's coming out at the end of this year called The Bellingham Bloodbath. I think that I will read it, but I really hope that it gets a little bit darker, a little bit more suspenseful, and a little bit quicker. Although the Sherlock Holmes novels, you can't say any of those about the Sherlock Holmes novels. They're not quick. They're not particularly suspenseful. They're not particularly dark. So, in that vein, that Gregory Harris is doing a very good job of imitation. I guess imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. So that's the Arnafour affair. Now, the last book I want to talk about is a book called The Ghost of the Mary Celeste by Valerie Martin. And this book actually, just by coincidence, has a strange connection to all of the three books that I just mentioned. And here's how. It's kind of strange how they all kind of work together, because I read these four all in a row. And if you notice, these are all four books by four authors I'd never read before, which I know I said last year I was going to try and stay away from books by authors I didn't know. I wasn't incredibly pleased by the four books I read this time around, but hey, what can I tell you? That's the way it goes. So Valerie Martin has connections to all three of the books I just read. First, Valerie Martin wrote a book a while ago called Mary Riley, which was made into a movie starring Julia Roberts and John Malkovich. And Mary Riley, I actually ordered the book because I'm interested in reading it. The book Mary Riley, if I understand correctly, it creates a character named Mary Riley, who is the, I guess, housemaid, or not butler, I'm not sure what the terminology is, the housemaid I'll use, for Dr. Jekyll. And so the book Mary Reilly is the housemaid's interpretation and perception of the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde story. So I said that I thought Mayhem was a takeoff on Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. Well, Mary Reilly, written by Valerie Martin, there's your connection. Now, the Ghost of the Mary Celeste has a couple of different characters, one of them being Arthur Conan Doyle, who, as you know, wrote the Sherlock Holmes novels. So Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes, The Arnafour Affair, Mangle Street Murders, this book kind of, like I said, fits with both of them. But I'm going to first read to you what the book jacket says, because I want you to hear what it was that drew me to this book and why I wanted to read it. And then I'll tell you what I expected and then what I actually got. So it's called The Ghost of the Mary Celeste. And this is what the book jacket says. It's very short. A ghost ship appears in the mist. To the struggling writer Arthur Conan Doyle, it is an inspiration. To Violet Petra, the gifted American psychic, it is a nightmare. To the death-obsessed Victorian public, it is a fascinating distraction. In salons and on rough seas, at seances and in the imagination of a genius, these responses converge in unexpected ways as the mystery of the ghost ship deepens. Intricate, atmospheric, and endlessly intriguing, The Ghost of the Mary Celeste is a spellbinding exploration of love, nature, and the fictions that pass as truth. I was expecting a ghost story. I truly was expecting something dark and sinister and creepy and raise the hair on the back of my neck, don't read it late at night, and I was really excited. I thought this was going to be a little bit of a creep fest for me, and I thought it was going to be ghosts and this ghost ship. I mean, it says a ghost ship. The ship just appears out of the fog and there's nobody on it anymore. And what happened? And this one character in the book who can talk to dead people and hold seances, and this other one who is the master of the modern mystery novel who must somehow figure out the mystery of the ghost ship. And and this Victorian era of England that is obsessed with death. I'm thinking this is going to be like, this is going to bring together everything. This is going to have it all. This is going to have the darkness of the Jack the Ripper with the mystery and the mysticism of it. And it's going to have ghosts and it's going to have seances and it's going to have, you know, the tables that rise up off the ground and the mediums who sit there with their eyes fluttering as they do voices out of their mouth. And it really wasn't that. And it was really kind of disappointing. Even though I liked the book a little bit, it just wasn't what I expected. And the book that I can closely analogize it or find similarities with is a book that I read last year called The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern, and some of you may have read it. It was a really good book, and it was really enjoyable, but it was kind of a glorified look at this mystical event that this night circus would appear out of nowhere, and it would have all types of circus circus attractions and magicians and wizards or kinds of things like that. And when I read The Night Circus, I wasn't expecting anything dramatic. I wasn't expecting anything sinister or devious or anything particularly deviant, I guess is the right word about it. And that's what I got. The Night Circus was a really enjoyable book, and it was more amusing and fun, and there was a sense of joy to it, and there was a sense of wonderment and awe to it. And there are passages in The Ghost of the Mary Celeste which are like that. When they're talking about one of the characters goes to, it's kind of like a convention for mediums and seances and people who believe in the spirit world. And it's at this, this retreat area, and it's like this fairgrounds, and there's hotels, and there's you can go to this event here, you can go to that event there, you can go to this, you know, cooking for ghosts or, you know, mediums 101, whatever it is. And it was a love story-ish ode to that type of a lifestyle. But the characters didn't really ever come together to the point where they were working together. I expected that they would all kind of converge and seek out the truth of this ghost ship together. And it didn't happen. The story is that Arthur Conan Doyle writes the story about the ghost ship of the Mary Celeste, and how the big mystery was that the ship leaves port in the United States with a full crew, and it arrives with nobody on it anymore. And apparently this is a true story. Apparently that's what happened with this ship. And so there's a big uproar. Well, what happened to the crew? Where did everybody go? Did they all get washed overboard? Was there a mutiny? You know, what happened? And so Arthur Conan Doyle, at a time when he was still practicing as a physician and struggling as a writer, he writes this story under a pen name, and he concocts this version of events of what happened to the Mary Celeste. And it's all fictionalized. And he knows it's fictionalized. He makes it up. Well, it turns out that there's a girl who's a medium who can talk to ghosts. And she is all in an uproar because she knows the truth, or at least believes she knows the truth of what happened to Mary Celeste. And she's upset because this author got it wrong. Well, she never really pursues that. She just has a righteous indignation that he got the story wrong, and she wants to know who to sue, and she can't sue anybody, so it just goes away. And you read a little bit about this medium, her name, Violet Petra, and there's a story at the beginning of the book for about 50 or 60 pages is what you end up finding out was the husband and wife, the captain of the Mary Celeste and his wife. So you learn about their courtship and how they ended up together, and you find out that the captain's wife had a sister who was a medium. And even though her name is Hannah, you kind of get the expectation that Hannah is really Violet Petra, and you meet Violet later. The story never tells you that they're the same person, but you kind of expect that they are. And so you learn about Violet, and you learn about her escapades as a medium, and how she talks to these people and that people, and how she basically bounces from family to family, acting as a medium at their instruction. She will have seances, and she'll give them information about their dearly departed, and then it's like a parlor trick. And then when that family is done with her, she gets pushed on to another family, and she resumes her duties as this parlor trick, basically. And so that's about it. The story comes to an end as Arthur Conan Doyle is finally lured into being given the diary of the wife of the captain on the ship, the Mary Celeste. And you find out that the diary was stuck in the captain's quarters under the bed, and that even though there was a complete inquisition and investigation into what happened to the Mary Celeste, somehow or other, this diary was not found, and now this diary makes its way into Arthur Conan Doyle's hands, so thus bringing the story full circle. And then the last 30 pages is basically the excerpt from this diary. And it doesn't really resolve what happened at the end. It doesn't tell you what really happened to all the people who were on the Mary Celeste. You find out what happened to the captain, but you don't find out what happens to the captain's wife. They had their daughter with them. There was a whole crew. You don't find out what happens. And I really was expecting more. I don't know why you get this far into the book and you don't provide some answer. Make it up. Now, don't make it up. Well, I was going to say don't make it up as it's this extraterrestrial supernatural being, because crap. I mean, there's mediums and they say they talk to ghosts, and you can make anything you want. You can call it, it's a ghost ship. It's what it's called, the ghost of the Mary Celeste. You can tell it what you want. You can make it what you want. You can come up with whatever theory you want as to what happened to the people on the ship. But the writer never brings that to a conclusion. And that, to me, is what drew the book down. Aside from the fact that I thought that the book jacket was completely misleading, because I was expecting kind of an eerie ghost story adventure, and I didn't get it. And there was a lot of fluff. There was a lot of stuff that just did not seem to have a reason for being there. There's a portion of the book that was Arthur Conan Doyle, while he was, I guess before he was a writer, and as he was a physician, he would go on sailing ships and act as the ship's physician during these voyages. And there's one portion of the book where he's the doctor on a voyage down to Africa. And it's like, okay, so what? What does any of this have to do with the ghost ship? Let's get back to the ghost ship. Tell us what happened to the ghost ship. Let's talk more about that. Let's talk more about the medium talking to people on the ship. Or let's talk more about what could possibly have happened. Give me something more like that. Build up the intensity. Build up the suspense. And the book just didn't do it. And I thought the book was really well written. Obviously, the author has a gift for writing, because it was enjoyable read. The language itself was very enjoyable. But it just didn't deliver on what the book jacket promised. And if the book jacket had said exactly what it was, I probably would have read it. I would have. I found it interesting. But I had a preconceived expectation of what it was going to be. And you got to know this as well. It happens to you. When you walk in with a preconceived expectation of what you're going to get and you don't get it, you already feel that you've been cheated. And if I had known that this was a book that was not going to be the eerie ghost story and a mystery that was going to have some sort of a resolution at the end, if I hadn't thought that that was what it was going to be, then I would have been a lot more, I think I would have enjoyed the book a lot more. As it was, one of the things that on top of that was frustrating was I rushed to get to this book. I mean, I saw it at the bookstore. I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to read this. This one's going to the top of the to-be-read list. And it was. I mean, I finished The Honor for Affair, and it was like 10 minutes later, I got to start this next book. I got to see what this is. I'm ready for a ghost story. I'm ready for this type of a suspense and dark, you know, eerie feeling. And it just didn't deliver. And that was disappointing. But I did order Mary Riley. It's out of print, so I had to get a used book off of Amazon. And I'll probably read it at some point in the future, obviously. But I'm interested in it. I've actually been looking for that book for a while since I'd read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I've wanted to find that book. I look in used bookstores, and I can't find it. So I eventually just decided to find it on Amazon, so I should get it next week. But I decided I needed to get back to the norm. I needed to get back to comfort. So the book I just started is Jonathan Kellerman's latest, called Killer, another Alex Delaware novel. I think he's up to, I think the book jacket said he's written like 35 books or something like that, and I think I've read all of them. And I'm really excited for it because it is a return to the norm. As I've said on a lot of different occasions, sometimes a poor book by an author that you love is better than a taking a chance on a book by somebody you've never read before. And these last four books certainly will be testament to the fact that sometimes, you know, starting reading a book by somebody you don't know, your expectations could certainly be taken down a peg. Or that's not the right way to say it. Your expectations may not be met because you don't know what you're going to get. I know when I read a Kellerman book or a Connolly book or a Tom Clancy book or a Jack Reacher book, I know what I'm going to get. So my expectations, they may be high, but I know that the expectations are going to be met. I know that they may not all be the best book I've ever read, but I know that they're going to be enjoyable. They're going to be characters I enjoy. They're going to be stories that I like, and that they're going to be enjoyable reading experiences. So that's that. Now, I do have a little bit of a tease for you. Because after I read this book, I'm going to read a book which I've got to find what it's called. It's on my Kindle, so I got to open up my Kindle again. It's going to be a book called Galveston by Nick Pizzolatto. And I don't know who Nick Pizzolatto is, but from what my brother tells me, he's the creator of the HBO series going on right now called True Detective, or True Detectives. I'm not sure which it is. But anyways, this was based on a recommendation from Phil, who you recall came in and sat with me as we talked about Stephen King's The Stand. And Phil emailed me a couple days ago and said, here's our next book for the book club to read and review. And he suggested that book. So he's going to read The Book Thief right now, I'm reading Jonathan Kellerman's book. And then after we finish our books, we're going to read that book together. And I think we're going to do another episode where we talk about that book. The benefit of that is you'll get two for the price of one, because I think I'm going to try and get him to talk about the book Thief as well, because I'm really interested in his review of that book. So I think that's it for this time. This is Rob Cohen for Book Therapy. Find me on Twitter, BookTherapy13. Find me on my blog at RobCohen13.com, Facebook.com/BookTherapy. Love to hear from you if you're out there. I think that is going to do it. And thank you for letting me lie on your couch.